Okay. So today we're going to talk about what I put here, right? The complexity of SOC theoretically and practically. Right, so first week we spoke about the theoretical background of where different positions come from, what the implications are halakhically. Then last week we spoke about the three factors that people use when they're posturing a shaila. Do they give precedence to textual precedent, to custom, both rabbinic and popular custom, and their own exegesis of the canonical texts? But that only gets you to the beginning of the issue, right? Because once you, even if you have this behind you, you sort of know that you follow precedent, and you sort of know that you follow minhag, and sort of know that you follow your own analysis of the sugyas. You still have to, whenever you approach a shaila, right? There's two very complicated things you have to do. One is you have to analyze all the halachic issues that go into the question. The second thing you have to do is analyze all of the metzius, right? These are not simple tasks. Any given question can include 10, 15, 20 different halakhic topics, and the metzius can be near impossible, if not actually impossible, to ever determine. So what I want to do is sort of do a little bit of a survey of some of the issues that go into psak, discuss a little bit what types of qualities a posek needs to have that allows him to answer a question considering all of this. We'll plunge in. So first thing I just wanted to put, this is the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin. And the Rambam there says, this is just to sort of debunk a notion that is out there. And the Rambam says, "Kol Sanhedrin Melech Rosh Kol Shemidu Len Yisrael Dayan Chinu Hagon." Any Sanhedrin or a king or leader who appoints for the Jewish people a judge who is not proper, who is not fit, Ve'eino Chacham BeChachmat Torah, and he doesn't know Torah, he's not sufficiently knowledgeable in Torah, V'roi Li'as Dayan, and therefore he is capable of being a judge. Afal pi shehu kulo machmadim v'yishbo tovot acherot arei zeh shemidu over b'lo taaseh. Even if he's the nicest person in the world and he has a lot of other good qualities, you violate an iser d'araisa for appointing him shenemar lo dakiru panim b'mishpat. You can't show favoritism in judgment. And from Misora we know that this means there's a prohibition on the person who appoints judges to appoint someone who is not roi. Amru chachamim, shema tomer ishponi noa oshivenu dayan. Because the chacham said, maybe I'll say this person is nice, so I'll make him a judge. Ishponi gibor oshivenu dayan, he's strong. Ishponi krovi oshivenu dayan, he's my relative. Ishponi yodea b'cholashon oshivenu dayan, he's really smart. Not in Torah, he knows all the languages. Nimtam ezakeh elachayav v'chayev et azakai. And he'll end up making the person who's innocent guilty, the person who's guilty innocent. Lo mipneishu rasha, not because he's evil. Al mipneishu eno yodea, because he doesn't know. V'kach ne'emar, therefore it says, lo zakiru panim v'mishpat, do not show favoritism in judgment. V'od amru, we also said, kol amamid l'Yisrael dayan sheino hagun, kilu ekim matzeva, anyone who appoints a judge who is not proper, it's as if he built a Matseva, he built a testament, a statue, a whatever exactly it is, to Avodah Zarah. Shneimar v'lotokim lecha matseva asher sonei Hashem Elokecha v'makom tamid lechachamim k'ilu natash ra. And if there are scholars around who are ra'ui, there are tamid lecham around, so it's if you planted an ashera. Shneimar lo tita lecha ashera kol eitzam mizbach Hashem Elokecha v'kein amru chachamim lo ta'asun iti eloi chesef Eloa haba bishul kesef v'zahav zadayan sheminu b'pnei ashro bilvad. And what does it mean to appoint a god or a dayan? Right, playing on the words, who is gold of gold or of silver is someone who is appointed only because he was rich. So the first point, which should be obvious but it's not obvious, and is a posek is not the same as a being a good pastor is not being a good posek, right? Being good pastorally, right? Getting A's in all your pastoral psychology classes doesn't make you a good posek, even if it actually makes you a good pastor. Right? Okay, fine. But, and this is a mistake that, while it seems elementary is a mistake that's made often. Right? People think, well, he's really nice, he talks to people very well, he gives inspiring speeches, etc., etc., etc. That may make him a great rabbi. We can argue about whether there should be rabbis who don't know Torah. Right? There are studim lakana lakan. You can probably guess which side I fall on, but there are people, right, who are admittedly very good at inspiring people, and they're very good in certain contexts, and they really do a wonderful job. And whether or not you think that the system should be set up that you need smicha in order to advance in communal leadership in that way, and therefore they have no choice but to get smicha, that's not the point. Point being is you should not confuse that with a posig. Because just like you wouldn't say, well, a doctor has really nice bedside manners, but his knowledge of medicine and his skill with a scalpel leave what to be desired. You wouldn't want that person being your doctor or your surgeon. The same is true of a posig. And halacha is extremely complicated. And I always find this line to be one of those very biting criticisms of large segments of our community. Right? Just because you say that someone is kulo machmadim, he's really nice, everything about him is good, he just happens to be an amaretz, it doesn't make him a posig. So what does make someone a posig? Right? So, Ruach Hamsin has a wonderful article, which I suggest that you read all of it, and I put the reference here, called Get You Wise Men Marshaling the Rabbinic Alumni to Meet Contemporary Halachic Problems. It's chapter 6 of Leaves of Faith, volume 1. Where he deals with the problems of finding people to be poskim. So part of the article deals with technical problems, that we don't pay rabbis enough, right? And then there's a footnote that between when it was written and when it was printed, right, salaries of rabbis have gone up, right? So this problem might slightly have been solved. But then he gets to the substantive question. So he said, what is a posig? So he points to the Rambam that I put in the middle of this summary. He says, right? He says, presumably, a posig has similar qualities to a dayan. So let's look at a different halacha the Rambam says by a dayan. So he says, "V'yesh l'nam note kol mi sheyirtzu l'dvarim yichidim, v'hu sheyeh ra'oi l'chol dvarim." So the Rambam is a famous shita that, and this is based on the Yerushalmi in Chagiga Aleph Chet. In order to give someone smicha, in order for someone to become ra'oi l'dayan and become a dayan, he has to be able to paskin in kol Torah kula. Even if you give him partial smicha, he needs to be able to paskin kol Torah kula, right? Step one is he needs to know everything. Keitzad, what's the case? Chacham mufla, shira'ui lehorot lechol Torah kula. A amazing scholar who can rule in every area of halacha. Yeshu beitin lismochoto. Bezin should give him smicha, v'litein lo reshut ladun, lo rot v'isur v'ater. But Bezin can, if they want, even though he can paskin everything, only give him permission to judge dinei mamonot, but not ritual law, o yitnu lo reshut v'isur v'ater, v'lo ladun dinei mamonot, or to give him permission to paskin in ritual law, and not in monetary law, o yitnu reshut lazeh lazeh, or give him permission in both, aval lo ladun dinei kenasot, but not to judge fines, Ola Dundini Kinasota, Balatir Bechorot, Bimumin, or not give him the ability to permit Bechorot, O Yinul Rashul Hatir Nidarim Bavad, Kitamim, Vichain Kolka Yotibasa. Yes.
Is that what modern Rebbeim or old school?
No, he's talking about original Smicha. Okay. Original Smicha. Now, why would someone need to know Kol HaTorah Kula even if you're going to give him local Smicha? Right? So, presumably, yeah.
So everything's connected.
So one, very practically, everything's connected. Right? Two, this is what Rosenzweig likes to develop, and it develops extensively. There's also a certain intuition that comes, right? Even if this Shaila really is any particular Shaila that you can isolate from a host of other Shailas, it's clear that someone, even if they know Hilchos, Brachos, inside out, upside down, if they don't have an intuition about how the halachic system works, then they might not know how to paskin. Because, when you learn Hilchos Brachos, if you just learn Hilchos Brachos, and you learn no other halachos, you would be under the mistaken assumption that we routinely ignore halacha as is written in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, and just don't keep it, right? Because that's what we do in Hilchos Brachos, right? No, you shouldn't, but in Hilchos Brachos, people don't say brachos like shekachalo ba'olamo, shekhalak mechach maso li'reyav, right? I as you can tell, I'm not a big fan of this. I do make those brachos. I made Shechalach Mechalach Masa L'Reyav on Chacham Uvadia when I went to his shir. I made on Rochenstein at some point. I made Shekachalo Ba'olama when I went to see the sequoia trees. I meant to say the bracha at the Levaya and forgot of Hayodeya, Raze, Olam, whatever exactly. What? That one, right? That you, however the Gemara explains it.
Right?
Well, I was all the way inside by the Arum. And when Alex picked me up and sort of, you know, threw me up for a second, you could see, you know, hundreds of thousands of people going down because I was right in the center. So, and if you, you know, learn Hilchos Avelos, you would be convinced that, you know, we routinely, halacha basically goes, Gemara says one thing, that's Nifsak and Rambam, Tur, Shulchan Aruch, all the Nosei Kelim, but we paskin like the Gesher HaChayim. And that would be what you'd be convinced, and this would be unlikely true, but, you know, at some point when you just learn through halacha, you sort of get a feel for how halacha works, and how authority works, and, you know, you also might be able to challenge the way conventional psak is, and say that maybe people are wrong, they just don't know the halacha, which is what many poskim say in Hilchos Avelos and Hilchos Brachos. And therefore it's important for someone to know Kol HaTorah Kula, especially the original smicha, which seemed to bestow a status on somebody, right? They actually changed them, they connected them to the Shalshelis HaMesorah. Now obviously our smicha is not that. What our smicha is a very good question. I'll probably give a share on this sometime in March, I think, right before, you know, YU bestows upon me smicha, or whatever exactly they do. I will give a shir on why what I'm getting is not smicha, and we can move on from there. Whatever exactly it is, it's not smicha. Okay, but coming back to our point, so, even though it's not a direct parallel, Rabbi Lichtenstein said it can act as a model, and he's correct. So the first thing you need, as we saw before, is chachma, right? And the sifrei adds bina. So what does it mean to be a chacham in this context? So, here's my summary of Lichtenstein. So, first of all, mastery of basic texts, both the content and the historical development of the halachic institutions discussed, right? You have to know, first of all, you should know Gemara, you should know Shulchan Aruch, you should know the Rambam and the Torah and the Beis Yosef, the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, v'chadome. You should also have a basic knowledge of who exactly is the Shulchan Aruch, who exactly is the Mishnah Berurah, what are we talking, how does halacha develop historically? Right? I don't mean like, you know, the way academics mean that. That's also fascinating. But simply to understand how things develop. And you should have a basic notion of how the Jewish community develops. Rilchenstein points out, you don't actually have to have everything at your fingertips. But the way he takes the Rambam is that you should have enough familiarity that with reasonable notice you can rule on any question. Rabbi Weider has suggested, I think brilliantly, that, you know, the way we have smicha tests where you have to memorize, if it's the Rabbanut test, every Mishnah Berurah and Chelek Gimel and Chelek Dalet of Mishnah Berurah for Hilchos Shabbos, if it's Kashrus, every Shachan Taz and Peschei Tshuva, that might not be the best way to give a smicha test, right? If you look at the Rabbanut test, there's only 10 questions, and I remember looking at one of the tests, and one of the questions was, what is the status of Chalav Zachar? So, yes, that is a dion in the postgame in 7 Pei Zion. No, this is not the central shayla you were getting. How often do you ever get a shayla about Chalav Zachar? What is Chalav Zachar is beyond me. Yes, it's a machal geshach rama. That's fine. I don't, you know, and it's discussed in the Prima Gadim. I don't understand it. He said what it should be is, you give a rabbi 10 questions, you give him whatever resources he wants, you give him whatever, 24 hours, and you say, here's the questions, here's the resources. If you get one of them wrong, you fail. Because that's how psak actually works. If psak doesn't work that I have to remember everything, because I can look it up. It does work that you can't get it wrong. Right? When you actually answer the shayla, you'd better not just assume that you remember it and then misquote Shulchan Aruch. That would be bad. So next point. Not only does he need to know things, he needs the ability to analyze the text and concepts, recognize what is similar and what is different. Now, Rilchenstein has pointed out in several contexts, and this is not his chiddush, the Lecha Mishnah says it in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perakei Alach Adalid. It's not really Lecha Mishnah's either, it's actually from the Ri, it's quoted in the Smach Mitzurich. that nowadays that we have all the resources, we have books, we have Bar Ilan, we have Otzar HaChachma, it's actually more important to be able to analyze than it is to be able to actually remember everything, right? At some point, or the Gemara says that it's more important to know everything because I call Otzar HaChachma the Chataya, the last Gemara in Brachos and in Horeos. But nowadays it is important to be able to analyze because getting the material is not so hard if you have a basic familiarity. Third thing, imagination. It's not just you have to be able to analyze concepts, but you need to be able to figure out what concepts apply, especially in new situations. It's not at all obvious, or the ability to grasp a problem and use his knowledge to deal with it. And you need to, first of all, be able to pull in, you know, creative reads, and sometimes you just need to be creative to figure out what the question is really asking. And the fourth is familiarity with methods of psak, especially if the implications of any given psak has more global ramifications because of the nature of our mobile society. Especially in the global world, you have to realize not just what your psak means, but what it means for the whole world. And then he puts a few moral things that you obviously need, too. He put unflinching honesty, both personal and intellectual. Three, you need to be totally committed to Torah and its values. Four, classic Lichtenstein, profound humaneness. And this is his line. He must be somewhere between those who would destroy every Jew for a din and those who would destroy every din for a Jew. Right? There is a certain level of humaneness in psak, but obviously there are certain red lines. Psak falls somewhere in the middle. If you are the type of person who could not care less about the people you're poskening for, your psak will likely be skewed. If you couldn't care less about the Torah you're poskening for, your psak will likely be skewed. Five, you have to be firm and at times aggressive. As Rav Lichtenstein said, he is the custodian of the Mesorah. And six, also a classic Rav Lichtenstein moment, you have to be humble and to quote Milton, as ever in my taskmaster's eye. So, leaving aside for a moment the later parts, because we'll get back to the moral parts and the specifically the humaneness, because this is going to be very relevant when we get to Psikat al Habisharat Chak, I want to focus on the first part. Simply understanding a shayla is extremely complicated. Some shaylas are pretty easy. I know. I get shaylas. Simple shaylas, I answer. Because, for better or for worse, I may not have smicha yet, but I've passed most of the tests, everything except for Erevin, right? This is the one I have to take. So technically I have a hetra hara and those, and you know, I had it before I got into smicha, also in a lot of issues. So people call me with basic shaylas, and basic shaylas are pretty easy. In kashrus, the answer is usually mutter. In Shabbos, it's often not. You know, but people call and they're like, I took my dairy spoon, I mixed, da-da-da-da-da, right? They're very, very simple. Sometimes you're surprised at how simple they are. You know, I had one Shaila where Ora's friend called her and she took a spoon and she stirred a fleishik dish. And then, like 5 minutes later, she took the spoon and she stirred a omelet with cheese in it in a small pan that had less than shishim. It was ben yomo, and everything was treif, which is a very stiff in shulchan aruch. That shaila never comes up. Neither Rabbi Willig nor Rabbi Weider, in all of their years of poskening, had ever actually gotten a shaila that was that straightforward. But that was pretty easy. Right? I was pretty sure that, you know, there's no shishim. It was ben yomo. That, if you know your idea, that shaila is pretty straightforward, pretty easy. But, you know, that's not true of many other shailas. And I put some examples on the second page, but we'll get to it. For example, if I asked you not what happens when someone stirs the wrong pot, but I asked you, what are the halachic ramifications of a dishwasher? Now the questions are a little bit trickier. I'm not even sure what to ask. And we'll get to it. So, often, especially when you're approaching new shaylas, it's not just having a mastery of halachic concepts, it's knowing what questions to ask, just figuring it out. You know, electricity, which we'll probably do sometime later in the year, was even more baffling, right? It wasn't even just like, it was applying several halachic concepts, it was inventing new categories of halacha, or copyright law, which confounded the Shaul Meshev and the Beis Yitzchak. They had no idea what to do with it. Or, what do you do with, and we'll get, again, these are a lot of things that we'll probably get to, what do you do with non-religious Jews who, unlike the non-religious Jews in the times of Chazal, have a movement which actually believes in certain Ikarei Emunah and has a philosophy behind not keeping Torah. Is that better? Is it worse? Is it both simultaneously depending on the issue? What do you do when you have a state of Israel? Right? We haven't had anybody deal with these shilas in a very, very long time, if at all. How do you set up a police force on Shabbos? And these were things that really complicated Psak, and no one really knew even what questions to ask. So that's part one of what complicates Psak and what a Posek needs. Now, Posek is an expert, like a doctor, but he needs, first of all, mastery of basic texts. Not necessarily know everything about that, but mastery. He needs to be able to figure out how to analyze those, and he needs to be able to figure out what questions to ask. What halachic concepts actually go into this particular shayla? And that is not at all simple. Now, let's say you've gotten to this point. You are a Graisa Talmud Chachem. After, you know, Shir Gimel, you've already memorized Shas Bavli, Yerushalmi, Tur Beis Yosef, Darkei Moshe Bach, Shulchan Aruch, Shachas Pitzchei Tshuva, Mishneh Berurah Archa Shulchan, and, you know, the main corpus of the main, you know, 15 Tshuvos of the last 200 years. So people are now asking you shailas. And you're brilliant, and you are Madame Milson and Milson, you know exactly what questions to ask, and you've gotten that far. So now, I have a nice theoretical framework, and I say, this is the halacha, if such is the metzius. Now, what is the next question? What? What is the metzius? What if it's not the metzius? Right? Psak is really complicated, because psak, unlike theoretical psak, is the tzomet bein ha-halacha la-metziyut. Right? In the Lashon of the Gemara, you are not allowed to take something as psak, as somebody's psak, if they say it's halacha. You're only allowed to take it as psak if they say ashiyom lacha halacha lima'aseh. Do you know what the difference is? The Gemara says this in two places, in Harios and Bava Basra. Right? Halacha is theoretical halacha. What are the concepts? What are the rules? Halacha lima'aseh is rules to reality. How do you paskin? So even if you've gotten past all of this complexity, then you have to deal with metzius. So Rav Lichtenstein likes pointing out this Gemara in Daf Hey in Sanhedrin, which says, Amar Rav, Rav, who was an expert in Matir Bechoros, and he was an expert in being able to tell when something was a mum that would be Matir and when it wasn't, said, what did I do? How did I figure out how to be Matir Mumin? What? For how long?
Years.
You want to read it? One line. I'm a Rav. Shmona Azar Chadashim Gidalti Eitzel Haroa Behema Leida Izumum Kavua Beizumum Over. I spent 18 months on a farm trying to figure out what is a permanent mum, what is a permanent blemish, and what is a temporary one. Now, the next source I put highlights two things about this. One, it's going to just flesh out the complexity and metzius of psak. It's also going to raise a philosophical question, which I don't want to get into, but it's important to raise, which is, once I say the obvious, that you can't paskin a shaila until you're able to know the metzius, because then you can apply the halacha to the metzius, well, what then is the status of the metzius vis-a-vis a kiyum in Limur HaTorah? And we'll see this piece. It's a fascinating piece. It's part of a very interesting article, Rav Aaron Kahn, who's mufursam in YU for being highly, highly, highly educated. He has several masters from Columbia in different languages. He's also famous for not being the world's biggest fan of Torah Mada. And he wrote a 98-page article in Beit Yosef Shaul Gimel about the definition of Talmud Torah. So the first section is understanding Metzius, Talmud Torah under any circumstances. Then it's the status of Hebrew language, and then it's the status of Tanakh, and then I forget what else it is. I did not actually force myself through the whole thing. Rav Lichtenstein quoted it in a footnote. So I was curious, I looked it up, I could not get through the whole thing. Also, his Bekiyas is astonishing. Anyways, so I've never seen anyone Bekalut be like, oh yeah, before the days of Bar Ilan. Yeah, it's Beferush in the Sefer Bina Svarim of Rev Azaria Pigo. Like, Ah, yes. The famous Rosario Pigo from Italy. Okay, so this is a drasha of the Chassam Sofer. And he says, Kedrush Shedarash, Pechet Teve, Chassam Sofer Shita Zo, Mitzura Nifla'a, Bemet, Sefer Torah Shalanu Hu Me'at HaKamut. Our Sefer Torah seems to be very small quantitatively. Katuv b'tocho, eze sipurei ma'asim, it says some stories, sha'avru, ve'eze mitzvot, v'chukim, and some mitzvot, and some laws, and mishpatim, v'shagubahem, am b'nei Yisrael, that the Jews should keep, v'omnam, yevshar mebli sharei chochmat kulam, but you can't move without other chochmah. Ki yevshar la'agiyah l'kabel edud ha'chodesh, and relish ne'idah kol dekdei hiluch ha'chamah, u'maslu lehem. You can't accept testimony about the new moon if you don't know anything about astronomy. You can't judge someone who's a witch if you don't know anything about magic. I don't even know what that says. What? Thank you. Hanituach al ofen hayoter dak v'amok. And you can't really know those travels if you don't know a little bit about surgery. You can't know much about singing, the Levium singing, if you don't know anything about music. And if you don't know how to measure things, you don't know geography, you're never going to figure out the borders of Eretz Israel. Agriculture, however exactly you say that. You can't know anything about Zerayim without knowing agriculture. And how much how impressive is it when you read about the 39 malachos that you see how much Chazal knew about nature? And obviously, you know, theology or religion is more important than all of these. But in the meantime, none of these sciences, geography, any of these chachmah, none of them appear in the Torah. We have nothing about this. And the nations of the world do. But now, what's the problem he's dealing with? Right, he just set out the mitzvahs very nicely. You can't paskin, you can't learn if you don't know a whole bunch of other things. But there's a mitzvah v'hagita bo yom vam v'layla. You have to learn day and night. So when are you going to learn geography? When are you going to learn astronomy? When are you going to learn magic? And when are you going to learn whatever? Vein kan shapnu yalamot kol elu. I don't know what magic is. And there's no free time. And now the Chassam Sofer throws in his philosophical assumptions here. And obviously God doesn't want us to learn this. Thank you, Rachbo, Aruka, Meyeret Mida, Rachava, Minayam, Vein Lecha Kol Chachma Ba'olam, Shlo, Nir Zema, Bimilota, Uve, Chiburea, probably. We safik, Kiba Vasuka, Cholishen Lochem, Ramaz, Kol Chamachamid, Kodesh, Kodesh, Yosher, Yoter, Mimasha, Etika, Ramam, Misfarim, Meyodea, Lishamit, Vazuka, Zay, Masay, Hakol, Mifurash, Vishom, Seichal. So, Some sort of, you know, solution is that obviously if I understood Torah well enough, I would get all of science from it. And clearly the pasuk of HaKadosh Zalachem, if I understood the Kabbalah and the numerology in it, I would understand all of astronomy. So that philosophical assumption I will leave you to grapple with. But the Chassam Sofer makes the, right, very clearly illustrates how important it is to know other chachmot if we want a paskin. Now, it also highlights the problem. And you know, I know, as Deborah Clapper once said, right? Rebbetzin Clapper, whatever she wants to go by. She always finds it bothersome that there are people who plausibly would say, and I might possibly say this intuitively, I don't really know why I would, that if I was reading a biology textbook or anatomy or medical textbook, I could read it in the bathroom. But if I was reading the Tzitz Eliezer's quote of that book in his Hakdama to a Tshuva, where he's about to paskin medical shayla, I couldn't read it in the bathroom, right? People sort of do have that intuition that that might be true. They would feel uncomfortable taking a Tzitz Eliezer into the bathroom, even if they're only reading the first, you know, just the scientific part. And often there are just scientific discourses, but they wouldn't do. But they would bring the book he based himself on. And it's interesting to think about why that would be the case. And once you recognize how necessary other chachmot are, especially for psak, you really do have to wonder where the line is between what's defined as Talmud Torah and what's not. Or you think there is no line, and you think everything is Talmud Torah. Or you think... But, yes.
I was talking to Rabbi, when he said Rabbi Lichtenstein totally believed that basically everything is Talmud Torah.
Rabbi Lichtenstein is a very expansive view, and Rabbi has a very, very, very limited view. Rabbi has said, and I'm not sure how much jest, that Nach is not part of Torah. And his raya is, if you pick up a Nach, Tanach, it says Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim. So you see that Michal Hein at the Shomei Alav, Michal Lav at the Shomei Hein. If this is Torah, then this is not. I don't know how plausible it is. I wouldn't go in that direction. Okay. But at any rate, I will leave the philosophical question aside, but it's important just to raise it, right? Once I establish that as important as it is to know halacha, it's equally important to understand metzias. If you want to paskin, you really do have to wonder, so then where does that leave us in terms of, first of all, just the technical question of, is this Talmud Torah, but also the practical question is, how much time should one invest in understanding the metzias? A good posek has no choice. The question is how much you should do in advance, how much you do, you know, in anticipation if you're going into Psak, how much the Messias do you need to understand, or do you need your, just, you know, to set up your resources, which is, by the way, what Ray Willig does. Ray Willig has many, many students who he's like, oh, I'll call my doctors, I'll call my physicists, I'll call my whatever, right? And he just has his rabbinic Rolodex, where he just calls up his experts in Messias. Just one more line here. There's a famous line from Baruch of Shklov in the name of the Gra. He said, right, as much as you lack from other knowledges, you'll miss 10 times that in Torah, because Torah and wisdom are intrinsically linked. And especially in the world of Psak, that is obviously true. Now, just to point out, there is a Mishnah that highlights this. It is grossly misunderstood normally. It's a famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Kinim upiske nida, hein hein kufei Torah, right? Tkufot vigamatriot, parparot lachachma, right? Nida and these are gufei halacha, and these are parparot l'chachma. Now, so what's shot in the Mishnah? Right, why did the Mishnah have to say this? Well, what is unique about the four cases in the Mishnah? Kinim, upitchei nida, hein hein gufei halacha, tkufot, ugematria, hein hein parparot l'chachma. What's unique about the four cases? They are all... mathematical, right? Kinim, if anyone knows, Moshe Kopel has written a book to figure out Kinim based on calculus. That's what you need to understand it, set theory, right? And different things. If you look, it's a little blue book, right? Because it's really, really complicated, because Kinim, by the end, is what happens if I'm not sure, and there's a suffix, and there's two people here, and they're both misupik, whether they brought the right carbon, and maybe one died, and you end up having to bring like 8 different groups to make sure that everyone was Yotze, and that no one brought the wrong thing, da-da-da-da-da. Pesach Nida is also extremely complicated in that way, between all the counting of the days, it's 7, 11, etc., etc., however you understand it, Machlokes Rishonim, as opposed to astronomy and math, which are also mathematical, but they are not gufo shel Torah, right? Certain times you need mathematics to understand Torah, and then they become gufei Torah, and if you understand, and if you study them divorced from Torah, they are parparot l'chachma. And the Mishnah just sort of cut to the heart of this question, that math can simultaneously be either Torah or only a parparat l'chachma, depending on the context. Okay. But that's just a philosophical aside. So now what we saw so far is what should be intuitive to everybody is that psak is really complicated. Because even not because besides for you know halacha being a lot, when you want to paskin a shaila, you need not only to have mastery of text, not only do you need to have sort of a worked out notion of how texts work, and that goes back to what we talked about last week, where you put what weight you give to independent analysis, what you give to minhag, what you give to precedent. You need to be able to figure out what shaila is even being asked. And on new shailas, you really need to figure out what halacha categories we've been talking about. And you need to be, therefore, creative. You need to be able to have a little bit of imagination. And you need to be able to see the totality of the system and be able to marshal it to answer a question. Once you get past the theoretical line, then you need to analyze metzius, which can be equally complicated. And Ray Clapper likes pointing out that there are some poskim who are very, very big mechatshim on a level of halacha, right? They have brilliant analysis, or they are rabbavadya, and they're just really impressive in how they marshal everybody who's ever said something. There's some poskim who, in terms of what they quote, very rarely quote anything like mind-blowing. Like Reb David Tzvi Hoffman, who like basically quotes Shulchan Aruch and Nosei Kelim, and I mean, the Gemara is in like the basic Rishonim, but like he very rarely pulls out some random shita from the middle of nowhere, and his analysis tends to be pretty straightforward. And despite that, he has a lot of groundbreaking tshuvot, not because of how he understood the halacha, but because he was able to understand the mitzius, or understand that the mitzius was different, and therefore just simply say that this is the halacha category we're talking about, and not this one. And it was therefore a very creative posek, even though he wasn't actually, in his tshuvot, a phenomenally creative lambda. Not that he wasn't a lambda, but most of his tshuvot are not, you'd read them, they're pretty straightforward. But it's in that gap between reality, or between theoretical halacha and reality, where he showed his creativity. So now what I wanted to do in the remaining time is just show two examples, not controversial examples. Later in the year we'll get to more controversial ones when we get to sort of Psikat halacha b'sharat chak, and really sort of the issues where halacha is really pushed. Now I just want to talk with a few issues that are just complicated. To just show how complicated it is to get a psak out, even if you knew the halacha concepts. So the first one is dishwashers, right? It's a very basic shaila, comes up a lot. So tell me, can you use a dishwasher for milk and meat simultaneously? Consecutively, neither or both? Right? Milk and meat dishes, consecutively? Right? Only consecutively, but not simultaneously? Even simultaneously, you can do both, or both of them are treif?
Simultaneously.
So there are poskim who think that. Rav Moshe, Rav Ovadia were very mekel. Right? Rav Ovadia was very mekel. Right? Minhag Olam is not even to use them consecutively. Why? What concepts even go in? What shailas are you asking? It's obviously a kasher shaila, right? Good. Now, what shailas are you asking? What concepts are involved? What shailas? What parts of kasher do I even need to know?
No sin dam lufkam.
No sin dam lufkam, right? For sure, I need to know sin dam lufkam. Great. So, what does that depend on?
The heat. The water.
Okay. So, first of all, the heat. So, the heat, right? What shailas come up in the heat? How hot the water is. What else?
Whether it touches all of it.
Whether it touches all of it. What else? Where did the water get cooked? Outside and it came in through a pipe, or inside? Why? Because what's the difference? If it came from the outside, then what is it? Klisheni. What's halacha? Well, klisheni, according to... Well, I don't know. It's a three machlokas in the Balei Tosfos. Right? Is klisheni is not mevashal on Shabbos, but maybe it's mevashal by kashrus, or maybe it's mevashal kidei klipa. So dishwashers are really complicated. So Rav Moshe was mekel, and Rav Ovadia was mekel. Rav Moshe, at least consecutively. Let's leave aside simultaneously for a moment, but consecutively they were mekel. Why? So first thing they said is, and I'll mix Rav Moshe and Rav Ovadia together, even though they actually focus on different points, but for our purposes at the moment, it's not such a difference. First thing they said is, well, the water comes from the outside, therefore it's a klisheni, so it's not really mevashal. Okay? Second thing they said is, oh, and there's soap. There for what? Well, according to who? According to the Shulchan Aruch, right? That if I wash dishes, and Shulchan Aruch says, near Eli, that if you wash dishes and there's ashes there, then you could wash milk and meat together because the ashes would make everything lifgan. Who argues in the Shulchan Aruch? The Shachan Taz, right? So, maybe we paskin like Shulchan Aruch, maybe we don't paskin like Shulchan Aruch, because obviously the Mechaber says we do paskin like Shulchan Aruch, right? And the Rebbe Avadya says we do paskin like Shulchan Aruch. Okay, now even if that's true about ashes, is our soap the same as their ashes? No, right? Rebbe Avadya says that even the Shachan Taz would agree that if ashes didn't make things no sin tam lifgam, but our soap would make it no sin tam lifgam. So Rav Avadya is making it, because look, it's not, right, at any rate, there's soap, and it's no sin tam lifgam, and the water's coming in suddenly klisheni, right? Maybe food is caught in the filter, and that might be, and then the last principle they pull in is, obviously, the most obvious is, bittul. Right? You've already cleaned the dishes, right? There's just residue, there's not going to be 60 of milk and meat, whatever, it'll all be bottled in the water. So they say, so, it's no sin tam lifgam, there's soap, which makes it really lifgam, the water is on the outside anyway, so it's cliche, so it's just being mixed together, but that doesn't hurt you. And it's, even if it was there, it's bottled b'shisha. Right? So first of all, the first thing you see is that, right, this is just a kashrus shayla, and you have to know, first of all, dishwashers is a basic kosher shayla, and you need to know. Right, first, just in the level of halacha, right, you need to know the rules of bittul. Need to know the rules of no sin tam lifgam, both the question of soap, the Shulchan Aruch Shachtaz, and you need to understand the rules of bishul, which comes from Hilchos Shabbos. We just borrow it to Hilchos Kashrus, right? And obviously you need to know, so at least 3-4 main concepts within Hilchos Kashrus, and one of them is borrowed from Hilchos Shabbos. And that's only halacha. Right, then, so that's the theoretical. Then the next step is that Rav Avadya and Rav Moshe argue, well, realistically, right, there's never going to be a piece stuck which is going to be more than shisha, because there's a lot of water. And it's the water is cooked outside, and therefore it's cliche, and it's in Mavashel. So, if you look at this very nice article by Rav Rosen, there's an article by Rav Pearl and Rav Rosen, right? Obviously two people who live right down the block, right? Rav Pearl is the Rav of the old shul, and Rav Rosen is the head of Tzomet, lives that way, right down Hashayarot. So he did a very nice job, and he summarized, here are the 7 tshuvot of Rav Moshe. This is what he says, and this is why he's wrong. So first he critiques him halachically. But then he says, first of all, it's not true that big pieces don't get stuck that are yosher mishishim. Second of all, he says, Rav Moshe didn't realize that there's not going to be shishim because Rav Moshe thought there was a lot of water, right? Basically, the way a dishwasher works, there's a lot of water. That's not actually how it works. It's a lot of water goes in and it quickly recedes. There's actually very little water in there when it's actually cleaning. We use the minimum amount of water, and in fact, dishwashers save water over washing it in the sink, because it's not a lot of water, right? The way the technology works now is it's very little water that's actually cleaned it. Like, it rinses it, but then it's really, really mad. Furthermore, Rav Moshe said that this is klisheni. He's wrong. The water doesn't come from outside. It's boiled inside. There's actually a filament inside that heats the water. So therefore, right, besides the challenge of halachic concepts, he said, look, Rav Moshe may have been right halachically, but he's wrong on all of his metzias points, and therefore, you can't use dishwashers for both meat and milk. In the responses, and they pointed out, if you thought this wasn't complicated enough, not only is it possible that dishwashers have changed, because they have changed, even when they were never the same between America and Europe, and they were never the same between America and Israel, because Israel tends to get into things from Europe. And even the old dishwashers were different between America and Europe, and Kal v'chomer, both of them have changed, and neither of them look like the dishwashers that Rav Moshe was talking about. So, First of all, he challenges everything Matthias, and there, second of all, he says that even if Ramosha was right, the Matthias has changed since Ramosha got the Shaila. So I didn't, don't expect you all to have followed everything I just said, because, like I said, you need to know a lot of concepts in Hilchos Shabbos and a lot of issues in Matthias. But the point, which should be obvious now in this little exercise, is that a very basic kasher Shaila, which is not like earth-shattering the way electricity is, because, like, it's not that different from a sink, right? It's just electric and whatever. Still, forces you know three or four very serious sugyas within Hilchos Kashrus, which don't necessarily come from Hilchos Kashrus, needs you to ask a series of Matthias questions, which not only have they do they change by country, they have changed over time, and therefore the Shaila just has to be re-asked every 3 years, and that's why it consistently gets an article in Tchumen and RJJ every few years, because the Matthias changes, and therefore it just keeps changing. And the implications of this are very, you know, critical, because if you look at, this is Rosen's article underneath, right? If you just look, he writes, Mechonena dachar kelim beitit, the home dishwasher. Hinash lav nosaf v'aliyat rarad chayim ha'israeli. Right? It is a step up in the life of Jews in Israel. This article was written in Tchumen Yud Aleph. We are now at Tchumen Lamed Gimel, so 22 years ago. Okay? More and more people are getting it. Basically, it's a normal thing now. Normal Jewish life. Why are you allowed to eat at your friend? You guys eat at my house sometimes, right? Why? There's no mashgiach. You trust me. Now, what does trust assume? First of all, that I'm a firm person, which may or may not be a good assumption, right? But even if it's a good assumption, you assume. Let's say I'm very firm. You assume that kashrus is easy enough that if I'm firm and I grew up firm and I know the basic halachos, I'm not going to get something wrong. At least not wrong to the point where it's actually going to make something trade. But what happens when you have a very serious problem where the Matthias has changed so much that you can't necessarily trust that? Because you may be really firm, but you have absolutely no idea what's going on. Right? So he says, "Im yachol matzav lezeli limashech la'achar, he kaneit ha-mikro gil u'mediach ha-gilim l'chol b'et Yisrael." Can this situation continue once the... In this article, it also deals with microwaves. Once there are microwaves, which are really complicated... and dishwashers, right? So it's not just that, right? The implications are real. It's not just like this is a complicated shaila. It's such a complicated shaila and such a common one that, depending on how you baskin, you might potentially think that for the first time in Jewish history, very well-meaning from people might routinely make things actually trafe, which is really, really hard. In kashrus, it's almost impossible to trace things up. It's because everything is always nosin tam lefgam. But suddenly, if you hold like Rav Rosen and you think that no, this is Kli Rishon and there's not Shishim and you're boiling everything together in the same dishwasher, you might actually trave up all your kalim. And if somebody did his dishes right before Shabbos and you're eating there Friday night, guess what? That's Ben Yomo and it's actually trafe, right? So you might actually have destroyed Cheskas Kashrus, right? When you get to a certain point of psak, of a level of complexity in psak, it's not just like it's hard to get the answer. You might actually radically change the rules of Ne'amanos. So, this should highlight not just the complexity, but that the complexity leads to very serious consequences, which means the responsibility of a posek is very, very, right? It's a very high level of responsibility. Okay, another example. Bugs in vegetables. Right? This is a slightly hot topic. So, what rules are there? This is pretty straightforward. What rules? Should I check vegetables? Should I not check vegetables? What's the rule? Very simple.
Check. Sometimes.
When do I check? When do I not check? Very simple rule. Miyud hamatzui. Right? If it's a miyud hamatzui, I have to check. If it's not a miyud hamatzui, I don't have to check. This is beferish on Shulchan Aruch. Great. What does a miyud hamatzui mean? How much is a found miyud? Hint, it's on the paper. Right? A. So it's machlokes. It ranges from 4%, 7%, 10%, or anything that would not surprise you is a miyut hamatzui. Anything that would surprise you is a miyut sheino matzui, which is presumably the actual definition of that word. Right? Both Rav Vosner and Rav Asher Weiss paskin that way. And apparently Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said it also. But let's say it's a percent. Let's say it's 10%. Great. 10% of what? Right? If you find a bug in 10% of X, then it's a miyut hamatzui and you have to check. Good. 10% of what? So the sheet is range, I put it here also, from bytes to servings to meals to wholesale shipments. Okay? So the range is, the positions now range, let's leave aside the whatever is not surprising possibility, but let's just take percentages. Raise to, if in 1 in 25 wholesale shipments I find one bug, is it miyut hamatsui? To, only if I find a bug every 10 bytes, is it a miyut hamatsui? Right? This is the range of halakhic positions on miyut hamatsui. Next problem. Let's say you are Rabbi Willig. Let's say you're me, and you go to Rabbi Willig, and you say, Rebbe, I know that you're very makil. I know that you think that miyut hamatsui is 10%. I left out, by the way, the more radical sheet, which is the Rivash, who thinks that miyut hamatsui is anything more than 49%. Okay, whatever. But Rabbi Willig thinks 10% of bytes. Right? Very makil shita. Okay, he's very makil. So I said, Rebbe, what vegetables do I have to check? And he said, I haven't the slightest idea. How am I supposed to know? He could come up with a really easy, right, really make a halachic shita. Great. Who did the research? Right? And what would research even mean? In my experience, in New York, in the Heights, which is the highest infestation of bugs of any place in New York City, right? Or what about in the Upper West Side? Or does it make a distinction whether I go to Trader Joe's, I go to, you know, Food Emporium, which is spotless, or I go to the sketchy place in St. Nick and 188th, right? Is there a difference? How do you judge Metzius? Who did the research? Is it different between Israel, America, and England? To the point where, if you look on the websites of the Star K, OK, etc., they're pretty machmir, right? Blackberries are treif, raspberries are treif, but corn is mutter. There are no bugs in corn. If you look at Ravai, who's the person who's like the big machmir posek in Eretz Yisrael, he says, how are you supposed to eat corn, cobs of corn? You can't. If you take a knife, you have to shave off all of the kernels of corn, and then you have to check each one individually, because corn is mukhzak bitolaim, and therefore the only way to eat it is after you've checked every kernel independently. So I asked someone, what's the mitzias? And the answer was, I have no idea. Rav Henkin, junior, right? Meaning, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin's son, Rav Eitam Henkin, published a book, which is in response to Rav Vai, called, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, Lachem Yihyeh Lo'achla, right? About the heter of eating vegetables. And also, he does the research. It's a very nice book. He's very makil. He's very compelling. In the end, he has two case studies. Two. The book is 162 pages. He has two case studies. 20 pages on corn and 20 pages on strawberries. Because that's all he managed to get through. And even he wasn't really sure. Because all the studies contradict each other. And no, the last study that's been done was partial and was done like 30 years ago. And if all of this weren't, you know, complicated enough, what everyone has pointed out recently is, let's say you think that corn is mutter. Is there a difference between regular and organic? Because what's the difference? Pesticides, right? So it may be, well, you've done all the research, you're making on corn, right? But organic vegetables might have pesticides. Without pesticides, might have more bugs. So here's two examples of relatively non-controversial topics, right? This is not like earth-shattering, you know, touchy topics that are dealing with people's feelings, and I mean, they are somewhat. It's a basic kosher shaila in the kitchen, a dishwasher, right? It's a glorified sink, right? And bugs in vegetables, which is a very old shaila, Right? There have always been bugs in some vegetables and some fruit, right? This is clear in Rishonim and Achronim. You come to the modern era. First, you've got to get past several levels of halakhic complexity. Then you've got to get to the Metzius. And everybody is groping in darkness. And you could be the best posek in the world, the most makil posek in the world, and Ari Willick is very makil, right? Saying that something is a miyut hamatsui is every 10th bite as opposed to every 25th wholesale shipment, right? That's a very big difference. And despite that, Rabbi Willick can't tell me in good faith that I can eat, you know, X, Y, and Z vegetable because he hasn't the slightest clue because nobody did the research. So, what this should point out, right, what this should highlight is that halacha is really, really complicated, not just on the theoretical level, but psak is by definition the tzomet between halacha and lima'aseh, between theory and practice. And that's not simple. And there may be no way of getting to the answer. So psak will sometimes be figuring out how to paskin when I can't figure out an answer because I just practically can't get to it. Okay, so much for right the theoretical discussion. I want to make one more point, and that is different works and how they address this point. And I want to make one point. Look at the bottom part, bottom of it. I want you to consider the difference between the Mishneh Berurah and the Shmirah Shavas Kelchasa. Okay? So, what's the difference? Anyone read either of them? Any part of either of them? Big difference between Shmirah Shavas and... Yeah?
I mean, Mishneh Berurah only deals with the theory.
Mishneh Berurah only deals with the theory, and Shmir Shabbos is framed around right modern application. When you read the Mishneh Berurah, what century do you think the Chafetz Chaim lived in? You know, not meant to insult the Chafetz Chaim. What century do you think he lived in?
Could be hundreds of years ago.
It could have been hundreds of years ago. What year did the Chafetz Chaim die? 1933 or something, right? Do you know what's glaringly, obviously missing from Hilchos Shabbos in the Mishneh Berurah? Electricity. Which existed in 1933. It also existed in 1900. If you look through Mishneh Berurah, he never mentions the existence of electricity. So, something you should consider, besides for just what I'm talking about, Psak, right? And this is different than our Hashulchan.
But it's not supposed to be... isn't it just supposed to be an explanation of the Shulchan Aruch? So if it's just an explanation...
So is the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan realizes that you need to at least address electricity. Now, this is whether you think this is a critique of the Mishneh Berurah or not, it highlights a point, right? The Mishneh Berurah is a very substantive work and a very serious posek, but if you try to take the Mishneh Berurah and actually paskin, you run up against a brick wall because the Mishneh Berurah did exactly what you just said. He analyzed theory. And living in the 20th century, he did not discuss electricity in the 6 volumes of Mishneh Berurah. Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, the reason Rav Neuwirth was such an influential posek in the world of Shabbos was because he organized it by Mitzius questions that actually came up. He checked with Rav Shlomo Zalman, so that was part of it, right, that he got... But Rav Shlomo Zalman was also a master of it, right? Rav Shlomo Zalman's books that made him famous first were Me'orei Eish, which is a book simply analyzing just the status of incandescent light bulbs, right? Forget the rest of electricity, right? He has other tools on that. So these two works also highlight, right, the problem, right? That the Mishneh Berurah could be a really, really, really good work, but practically when it comes to figuring out, can I use electricity on Shabbos, or can I use electricity for Havdalah, for, you know, my Havdalah candle, or can I use it for Neiru Shabbos? Right, the Mishneh Berurah is completely unhelpful because he only gives you theory, and despite the fact that he lives in the 20th century, is dealing on a theoretical level, and therefore it is a code, but it is not a practical guide. Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa realized that Psak, by definition, requires extensive research, and that's why Shmir Shabbos, you'll hear famous Psakim, not about, you know, Sif, X, Y, and Z in Shulchan Aruch, but what is the status of a Dud Shemesh? Right, what is the status of a solar panel heated water heater, right? Because that was famous, that he changed his mind between the different volumes of Shmir Shabbos because he was dealing with Mitzius questions. And Zuhair of Lichtenstein points to Shmir Shabbos as, you know, the paradigmatic example, pretty sure I heard it from Lichtenstein, of a posek who wrote a code, which was actually grappling with modern issues, as opposed to Mishnah Berurah, which didn't. You know, Shulchan here and there, but Shmir Shabbos dealt with it in a systematic fashion. Okay, so to summarize what we did, and I hope through my illustrations that might have lost you and that might have been part of the point, was to deal with the complexity of Psak, both theoretically and practically. So the first level is that Psak is really complicated because, first of all of Halacha affects all of the rest of Halacha. So just to have an intuition about how Halacha works is not enough to know Hilchos Brachos. In order to understand Hilchos Brachos, you need to know Hilchos Kashrus, Hilchos Shabbos, etc., just to know how the Halacha system works. Once you have that behind you, and everything we talked about last week, your basic principles of how you're going to Paskin, you need to be able to know what Shaila to ask. Because most questions, even the everyday ones, relate to 3, 4, 5 different halachic areas. Sometimes they're local, sometimes they're global, and you have to know that. Even once you get past that, in the intersection between halacha and reality, first of all, you need to know what reality questions to ask. Second of all, you need to do the research. You need to figure out how you're going to confirm it. And sometimes it's going to be so complicated that it's really going to be impossible. And you should realize that because of this complexity, first of all, a posek, right, it's not enough that he's a nice person. A posek is an expert. Right? He has to be an expert both in halacha and in the ability to harness both halacha and realia. Also, as we saw in Rosen's article, when halacha gets that complicated, it might actually undermine people's ne'emanos simply because you can be as firm as you want, but when halacha gets really complicated, people may not know what to do. So you have to realize that the responsibility a posek has is therefore very, very high, because when shailas get complicated, the stakes are also raised. And the last point is that you should realize that there is a tendency in, you know, that there is a tendency in different poskim to either focus solely on theory because of this complexity, but then you have to realize the limitations of that sefer, like the Mishnah Berurah, which is very good in what it does, but is much more helpful in Hilchos Brachos than it is in Hilchos Shabbos, as opposed to Shmirah Shabbos, which, on the one hand, its benefit, obviously, is that it grapples with halachic issues, but the obvious problem is it doesn't have the scope of the Mishnah Berurah, because if you're really going to try to deal with the reality, you're going to be limited to what you're able to answer, because, you know, it's two thick volumes and it only deals with parts of Hilchos Shabbos. So, this should have highlighted to you the complexity of halacha, and realize, you know, that, like I said, the gap between halacha and halacha lamaaseh is a very large one, and you realize that what it means, therefore, for someone to be a competent posek, and how difficult psak can sometimes be, and, you know, in the continuing weeks, we'll try to flesh out some of the points, but this was just to sort of highlight the issues that are involved from the bird's eye view.